Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. On Sunday, President Biden's key piece of climate legislation was dealt a major blow when Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, told Fox News he will not support the bill. The climate portion of Build Back Better, which was passed in the House, would create a civilian climate corps and allocate more than $550 billion to energy and climate programs. Here is Senator Manchin.
If I can't go home and explain it to the people of West Virginia, I can't vote for it. And I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there.
You're done. This is a no.
This is a no.
That is Senator Joe Manchin on Fox News yesterday. Not one Republican senator supports Build Back Better. Because the Senate is evenly split, the Democrats need all 50 senators to vote yes, plus a tiebreaker from Vice President Kamala Harris. According to the Washington Post, Senator Manchin's announcement also jeopardizes a provision that would extend benefits for coal miners with black lung disease for another decade, an important issue in West Virginia. If this bill does not pass by the end of the year, funding for those benefits will drop by half. In recent months, Senator Manchin's financial ties to the coal industry has been getting a lot more attention. According to an investigation by Alex Koch for the Center for Media and Democracy, Senator Manchin makes about $500,000 a year in dividends from Enersystems, a coal and energy resource company he founded in 1988. Between 2011, the year covered by his first Senate disclosure filing, and 2020, Senator Manchin raked in a total of $5.2 million in dividend income from Enersystems. Senator Manchin has reaped more campaign donations from the oil, gas, and coal industries than any other senator. In June, former top Exxon lobbyist Keith McCoy said he was talking to Senator Manchin every week. Keith McCoy thought he was taking part in a job interview. He was actually speaking to someone from Greenpeace about buying off members of Congress. Senator Manchin is at the top of their list. And here is a clip from the Channel 4 investigation.
When you have an opportunity to talk to a member of Congress, you know, I liken it to fishing, right? You know, you have bait, you throw that bait out, you know, it's all these opportunities that you use, and to use the fishing analogy again, just to kind of reel them in, because they're a captive audience. They know they need you, and I need them.
Senators pressed to do Exxon's bidding behind closed doors.
You want to be able to go to the chief. Yeah. And so the chief knows you, that you can go to the chief and say, look, we've got this issue. We need Congressman so-and-so to be able to introduce this bill. We need him to make a floor statement. We need him to send a letter. Yeah. You name it. We've asked for everything.
So who are the fish?
I'm Joe Manchin. I approve this act because I'll...
The biggest catch, according to Mr. Coy, is the conservative Democrat Senator Joe Manchin, who famously shot President Obama's cap-and-trade climate bill.
And I'll take dead aim at the cap-and-trade bill.
Joe Manchin, I talk to his office every week. He is the kingmaker, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate.
Legal declarations show that Senator Manchin has received tens of thousands of dollars from ExxonMobil and its trade associations.
And that is Exxon lobbyist, former Exxon lobbyist, actually now, Keith McCoy, who thought he was having a job interview, but he was speaking to someone from Greenpeace. McCoy named 10 other senators as crucial to ExxonMobil, including Mark Kelly, Chris Coons, John Tester, and Kirsten Sinema. So what now? Well, Senator Chuck Schumer said the Senate will vote on a revised version of the Build Back Better Act that passed the House early in the new year, so every member can make their position known on the Senate floor, not just on television. Senator Schumer says we will keep voting on it until we get something done. Joining us to talk about what this means for the Climate Agenda are two guests. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute and Director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Professor Mann is author of several books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Hi, Professor Mann. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Yeah. Hi, Rose. It's good to be with you.
Great to have you. Kate Aronoff is a staff writer with The New Republic and co-author of A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Well, great to have both of you. I just wonder what your overall thoughts are that Senator Manchin decided to make this statement yesterday on Fox News and apparently blindsided the White House. Professor Mann, what are your overall thoughts about what just happened?
Yeah, well, I thought you laid it out quite clearly. This is exasperating. This is clearly an individual with deep conflicts of interest when it comes to responsible votes on matters that impact our environment and in particular the climate. And it's unfortunate that Democrats are in this position right now where they need every single Senate vote that they have, every single Democratic senator, and a tie-breaking vote by the vice president to advance this legislation. That is going to prove a challenge as long as Manchin, maintains the position that he's expressed here. And it looks like he is pretty entrenched in that position. It may be important for Democrats to actually see if they can reach out to one or two moderate Republicans, perhaps somebody like Lisa Murkowski. I'm sure she would enjoy the chairmanship that Joe Manchin currently occupies. There may be ways to bring along one or two moderate Republicans, but this is, make no mistake, this is the sort of problem that you have when you have such slim majorities. And what Democrats really need to do is to turn out very large majorities of voters. So it isn't a 50-50 Senate. So they've got more than votes to surpass a filibuster attempt. And that's going to prove difficult as well if there isn't voter protection legislation passed by this very same Congress. And here again, Joe Manchin has indicated that he may end up proving to be an obstacle in efforts just to get basic voter protection legislation so that Democrats have a fighting chance in this next election, because that's what we need. We need larger Democratic majorities if we're going to advance this sort of legislation, let alone even bolder legislation that really meets the moment when it comes to the climate crisis.
Kate, what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts about how Manchin handled this?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think with most of what Michael said, that is. And I think, this is the same story that we've seen for months now, right? Joe Manchin says, I won't vote for this, or come back to me with something I like better. And then the proposal gets watered down. I mean, already him and this small radical faction of Democrats who do not represent the party, do not represent, the 81 million people who voted for Joe Biden on this, platform to pass, sweeping social spending, climate legislation, et cetera. They have really held up this agenda. And that, has been the case for months now. Again, and it's because of some of the structural problems that Michael was speaking to. I mean, Democrats are really caught in this sort of vicious cycle, unfortunately, right? Is that the party, for many years has not delivered for voters, and that makes it very difficult to run elections. And then, you get this whole thing over again, majorities that are very slim, if not, the party being out of power. And it is very difficult to see a way out at this point, because we are in this situation given, that there is virtually unlimited money from the fossil fuel industry and other major corporations, of course, pouring into congressional offices, most notably Republicans, right? Who, we shouldn't forget are, as you laid out in the intro, universally not supporting this legislation or any piece of constructive legislation, really. But, Democrats are taking that money too, as the Greenpeace investigation showed, and, have no real fealty toward their constituents. They are getting a check from some of the most powerful corporations on earth to do exactly this, right? To stop this legislation from getting through. And that, you know, not only keeps them from having to abide by the very modest, we should say, climate rules that would be, you know, included in this bill, which, you know, whether or not that would actually have any bearing on their profits, I think is a bit of an open question, particularly, you know, given how this could be even further cut down from the more than $4 trillion that's been lopped off this package already. But it also, you know, is very likely to hand power back to Republicans if Democrats don't have anything to show to voters that they will remember come the midterm elections next year. And that, you know, is very good for fossil fuel corporations, for pharmaceutical corporations who don't like to pay taxes, don't like, you know, to abide by basic regulations, which are all the things that Republicans will deliver for them.
Right. You know, a lot of people are saying this just shows how broken the system is, that one man has this much power. And when this happened, we immediately thought of frontline communities and young activists. Varshini Prakash of the Sunrise Movement said the bill's death is not just Joe Manchin's fault. Its failure is also on Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer. They had a moral obligation to play hardball with Joe Manchin, and they chose not to. Professor Mann, what are your thoughts on that? What else could the Democrats have done, and what else can they do in the coming month?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful, to be perfectly honest, in, you know, recognizing the difference between friend and foe. You know, it's clear that Joe Biden does have a bold agenda on climate. He laid that out in the first few months of his administration. But there's only so much that you can do with executive actions alone. And in fact, his effort, for example, to prevent the construction of new pipelines on publicly owned lands has met resistance from a conservative court that has rebuffed his efforts there. So the administration is, as far as I'm concerned, on the right side of this. You know, Nancy Pelosi and Democrats in the House, they passed an extremely ambitious climate plan, an extremely ambitious version of Build Back Better that includes major provisions for climate, some that we've already talked about, subsidies for renewable energy, funding for, climate efforts to mitigate the impacts of climate change on frontline communities, increased resilience, and most importantly of all, what's known as a clean power, clean electricity standard that requires energy producers, utilities to provide up to 80% of electricity from renewable sources by the end of this decade. So if we were to implement all those things, then indeed we would be keeping our obligation to the rest of the world. We would be keeping our obligation to lower our carbon emissions dramatically over the next 10 years. But what we have right now is resistance from conservative courts, and the ground for that was laid under the previous administration. We have all of these conservative judges now, including a Supreme Court with a large majority of conservative judges that are in a position to block any bold executive actions that the administration might take, and we're unable to codify the priorities of the administration in legislation because of, I would point out, not just one or two Democrats, but 50 Republicans who appear to be against any of these priorities, including doing something about our climate. It's easy to focus on one or two Democrats, and it's unfortunate that there are a couple Democrats who are on the wrong side of this, who are taking a lot of industry money, who are clearly suffering from conflicts of interest. You know, but let's recognize the vast majority of Democrats are on board. They support bold legislation, and we're coming up against some of these, you know, very difficult obstacles that were laid when Democrats didn't turn out in large enough numbers in midterm elections and even in the last presidential election. If we had 60 Democrats in the Senate, we would be looking at a very different situation here. We would be passing meaningful climate legislation. So in the end, it really does come out come back to us, turning out in large numbers, not just in the presidential elections and not just in the midterm elections, but the off-year elections as well. And what's happened is we haven't seen large enough Democratic turnout in some of these elections, and we've lost so much ground, and now we're reaping what we've sown. But again, it's going to come back to somehow finding a way to pass voter protection legislation. That's even more important, in my view, right now than the climate legislation, because without a functioning democracy, and we're in danger of losing our democracy here, there is no climate action. There is no American leadership on climate. And without American leadership on climate, there's very little hope of meaningful global action on climate.
We have a caller on Senator Manchin, and then we'll get Kate to respond. Let's hear from Judy in Berkeley. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Well, a couple of things is, one, Manchin has never been a moderate Democrat. He's a very conservative man. And the second thing is, I am so sick of the Democrats trying to pretend like they have a 50-50 split. With Manchin, they never have. They've never been realistic about it. And they've let themselves look like idiots. And we've all been strung along with this. And it's just really upsetting to me.
Well, thank you for the call, Judy. Kate, what's your response? I have to say, I was really surprised during the election when Democrats spent hundreds of millions on these Senate races. Yeah. That at least nationally, they barely brought this up, saying, you know, we need a majority in the Senate. And if you give it to us, this is what we're going to what we're promising you. But if we don't have a majority, it's going to be really, really hard to get things done.
Yeah. I mean, for that and other reasons, I would be a bit more critical of Democratic leadership, both in Congress and the White House than Michael is. You know, because we can see this coming, right? This is not a totally dissimilar situation from what happened in 2009 when there were much stronger congressional majorities to pass climate legislation and it didn't happen, right? I mean, the structural position that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden and his administration are in is, of course, you know, very difficult for all the reasons that we've talked about before. But we've known, right, from the beginning, given, you know, the sheer amount of fossil fuel cash, which is flowing to Joe Manchin, what he was going to do all along. And yet, you know, it's sort of like Charlie Brown getting the football lifted out from under him every time. There is still this belief, right? That he'll come around, that he'll see reason, when, you know, we've just had this endless process and seen this bill get trillions of dollars taken off of it, right? And that, you know, is really, a counterproductive process. You know, I think probably that Chuck Schumer is coming to the right decision, you know, forcing a vote on this, because this is a charade, right? I mean, we need to, you know, go forth and actually get things done and try to get whatever version of Build Back Better can pass at this point, you know, which is much, much weaker than what might have passed if it had gone to a vote months ago, right? And, you know, use the sort of considerable powers that are at the president's disposal. The United States presidency is a very strong office. And I think both in terms of the negotiations on this bill and the sort of broader powers that the administration has, you know, there are just a lot of tools which have not been picked up, right? I mean, there is this committee chairmanship that, you know, that Joe Manchin has, which could be, you know, questioned more aggressively. I don't think that's ever really come up for consideration, right? Despite the fact that Joe Manchin considerably and consistently acts functionally like a Republican in many cases. I mean, I don't know, you know, and I follow this stuff quite closely, whether anybody is actually just offered, you know, to create a $100 billion earmark for West Virginia in this bill, right? There are all these things that, you know, could be done. Would that fix it? Would we have gotten a $6 trillion Build Back Better agenda? I don't know. We'll probably never know that counterfactual. But it would be, you know, as Varshini said, Varshini Prakash at the Summers Movement said, you know, it would be nice to see Democrats really playing hardball instead of going along with this myth that Joe Manchin is going to come along. I mean, let's also just not forget that the sort of value proposition Joe Biden presented running for office, that he was going to bring so-called moderate Republicans on board, right? And as we see, he can't even get, you know, this sort of caucus of radical centrists on board for his own agenda, which is, you know, again, not just not just Manchin, right, but includes people like Josh Gottheimer, who slowed this process down considerably, the congressman from New Jersey. So, you know, I don't think there are any easy fixes to this. And it's you know, I think only so useful to sort of cast blame to people who, again, are in very difficult structural positions. But I think there really is just a lot more that Democrats can and should be doing, in no small part just to win elections, right? There's no path toward comprehensive climate legislation that does not run through sustained Democratic majorities. And toward that end, you know, on climate and outside of it, there's just a lot that can be done, right? Forgiving student debt, right, is something that Biden could do tomorrow, to not start up student debt payments in February, which is scheduled to happen, right? Legalizing marijuana is something that Biden could effectively do and would be very popular, right? So I think that is a priority, alongside voting rights, ensuring the sort of ability of this country to continue having some semblance of democratic institutions. I think there is a lot of work to be done, and further sort of prolonging this endless infrastructure week is not really helping us get there. Hmm.
Well, thank you for that call. Kate Aronoff is a staff writer at The New Republic and author of A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and the author of several books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Today, we are talking about what is next for the planet and climate policies. Now that Senator Joe Manchin says he will not vote for Build Back Better, he made this announcement on Fox yesterday. This morning, Senator Schumer says the Senate will vote on a revised version. We're not sure what that means of the House Build Back Better Act early in the new year, so every member can make their position known on the Senate floor, not just on TV. Senator Sanders was also on the cable shows yesterday saying, we have to vote on this. Every politician needs to go public. If you have any questions or comments on where we are right now, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Before we go to break, Professor Mann, I mean, what are our options at this point? Because you think about frontline communities, you think about young people, you think about people living in other parts of the world, the climate refugees. What happens in the United States obviously affects the entire planet. So what are the options here? I mean, people are talking about executive actions. We just got a tweet from a listener who says, Biden must declare a national climate emergency and fully fund all climate provisions of Build Back Better. What are the options now?
Yeah, you know, I agree with much of what Kate had to say. What's frustrating here is that Democrats as a whole, as a rule, don't have the killer instinct that Republicans have. We want them to be bolder. We want them to to test some of these gambits, to test the limits of the system, to use whatever mechanisms are available to them. And they're never willing to do that to the extent that Republicans are. And so there is this fundamental asymmetry, and we have to contend with that. We're not going to change the nature, the complexion of the Democratic Party overnight. What we do have to do, what we can do, is use our voices, is march in the streets, as children around the world have been doing, and raise such levels of awareness of the crisis that we face, not here, just here in the United States, but as you mentioned, the rest of the world, particularly areas, countries that had very little role in creating this problem and have the least resources to deal with it. So there's a fundamental ethical quandary at the heart of this issue. We need people to use their voices, to turn out, to demonstrate. That has moved the ball. We've made quite a bit of progress. And, you know, 10 years ago, there wasn't that sort of pressure, and we weren't seeing the devastating consequences of climate change that we are seeing today. And so there is a much greater opportunity to pass meaningful legislation. I don't think it's analogous to the efforts 10 years ago. I think we came extremely close. And if we had larger majorities, if 4 or 5 Senate seats that looked winnable by the Democrats, but ultimately were not gained by them in the last election. If we had that, then we would have Build Back Better. I'm absolutely confident about that. And so now we do need to overcome these obstacles. We do need comprehensive voter protection legislation. That's the most important thing right now. And we have to put pressure on Joe Manchin and every other Democrat to support that legislation, because that will at least give us a fighting chance to build larger majorities for climate action and to elect real climate advocates.
Kate, I know we have to let you go, but what are your final thoughts on what happens now?
Yeah, I mean, my basic point is the same. I think this process has to end as quickly as possible so that Joe Biden can start using the sort of vast powers at his disposal to, you know, not only do things like declare a climate emergency, which opens up a whole range of authorities that he could use, but, you know, sort of get to delivering for people in this country, right? That is what needs to happen. And I think voting rights is an essential piece of that. And you know, ensuring that we can have democratic institutions moving forward, but without, you know, having something to sort of put in front of voters as a real value proposition for democratic majorities. I just think it's very difficult to win elections, and that, you know, locks us into a very, very scary situation where, you know, climate legislation is impossible, not to mention, you know, I think a functional democracy.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Kate Aronoff is a staff writer at The New Republic and co-author of A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. Thank you, Kate.
Great to be here. Thanks so
much. Great to have you. Coming up after a short break, we'll continue our discussion with Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Now that Senator Joe Manchin says he is a no on Build Back Better, he made this announcement on Fox yesterday. What is next for the planet? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our discussion about Build Back Better. We will talk about the provisions that will help children, elders. There's so much in this bill, the child tax credits, providing universal pre-K, requiring Medicare to renegotiate drug prices, and so much more. What now on all of these very, very crucial issues? We will talk about that tomorrow, and then we'll talk about some of the other money, the non-climate money that Senator Manchin is also receiving. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce has been spending a lot of money on this, and so we're also going to follow the money tomorrow. Today, we are talking about the climate provisions in the bill and what this all now means for climate change. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today, we are joined by Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Now we'd like to welcome Rebecca Lieber to the show. Rebecca is a climate change reporter for Vox, who just wrote a piece, Joe Manchin May Have Doomed American Climate Policy. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you spoke with a number of people about what this means. You've been writing about this for so long. What are your thoughts on where we are right now?
Yeah, so yesterday was pretty grim. It caught, I think, the political community and climate community by surprise. Of course, just hearing Joe Manchin announce that he wouldn't support Build Back Better on Fox News, of all places. So I got a range of reactions from climate activists and experts who've been working on this bill for the better part of a year. And I mean, the reactions ranged from catastrophic failure to people calling Manchin's excuses utter nonsense, and to I guess it would be downplaying the kind of the response and backlash to Manchin as just saying that people are upset. I think the important thing here to keep in mind is this is a larger story than just a political story about the Biden administration. This is about our response to climate change and the broader climate crisis that the world faces. So I think it's important to just keep that context in mind when I think a lot of media and experts tend to gravitate to the political repercussions, but this has real implications for our response to climate change.
I was really struck by your one of your tweets yesterday, Rebecca. You wrote, "More people will die in the next 10 to 30 years because Manchin killed Build Back Better. The original proposal had ambitious policies to end coal pollution. This is not hyperbole." And you linked to a Harvard study that says the additional health benefits from cleaner air would be immediate, substantial, and widespread. It would save 317,500 lives from 2020 to 2050, 9,200 premature deaths avoided in 2030 when the policy reaches 80% clean electricity. I mean, it's obvious, but it's so important. We're talking about obviously the planet, but also people's lives here.
Right. I'm glad you bring up this point because I think it's really easy to forget, given just that coal and gas has been part of our lives for so long, that there are real repercussions of this. The particulate matter, particularly that's released by coal plants, leads to premature deaths. It causes a range of health problems that science has only gotten stronger proving those links in the last few years. And we can calculate the number of lives that are saved when we make this transition to clean energy. So just imagining that future and how close we are to a society where we are powered by renewables instead of coal, and the what that means for public health, and particularly the communities that live near these plants, that includes Joe Manchin's own constituents in West Virginia, that we would see substantial improvements in people's livelihoods and their lifespans just by making that jump from coal to renewables.
Professor Mann, this is so important. Can you also talk about the human aspects of this? The New York Times also had a piece about people of color more broadly. Black, Hispanic people, Asian Americans are exposed to more pollution from nearly every source, and also low-income people.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And again, it drives home this sort of ethical quandary here, that those who had the least role in creating this problem, developing nations that use relatively little energy and relatively little fossil fuels, and minority communities in this country who are often exposed directly to the toxic consequences of our continued use of dirty energy sources and have the least resources and resilience to deal with the impacts of climate change we're now facing. And in fact, the numbers that you guys were discussing just a moment ago, if anything, are optimistic. There is one recent study from within the last 2 years that estimates that climate change, when you take into account of everything we've talked about, but also these devastating extreme events, these floods and heat waves, the heat stress that comes with that, devastating wildfires, superstorms, 5 million a year, 5 million lost lives a year is what some scientists are projecting from climate change. Now, 5 million is also the total number of lives, at least officially by the official tally, that have been lost to COVID-19 thus far. So imagine the same thing, but year after year, not something that ultimately goes away as COVID-19 to an extent will, but something that just continues on and on every year and gets worse and worse. That's the road we're headed down if we fail to act. And so any way you slice this, whether it's the economic consequences, the national security consequences, the health consequences, or simply the consequences for human lives, it costs much more not to act on this problem than it would by any measure cost to act on this problem.
Professor Mann, I understand that you recently attended a climate science conference. The Washington Post wrote about this, that scores of studies presented at the world's largest climate science conference offered an unequivocal and unsettling message that climate change is fundamentally altering what kind of weather is possible, and its fingerprint can be found in the rising number of disasters that have claimed lives and upended livelihoods around the world.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, Professor Mann, I mean, we've had you on so many times. It's hard to keep up. Heat waves, floods, wildfires, yeah. Droughts, sea level rise. I mean, we hardly talk about coral reef. Sometimes we give them their own show because they deserve it. But there's so much.
Well, let's talk about tornadoes, too.
Yes.
What we just saw over the last couple of weeks. Another tragic, devastating, and deadly event that undoubtedly was exacerbated by climate change. And we can connect the dots pretty clearly on this now. You put more heat in the oceans, and the Gulf of Mexico is at near record levels of warmth. You put more moisture, more heat into the atmosphere, which can be converted into the turbulent motions that combine with spin in the atmosphere to give us these increasingly devastating tornadoes and larger tornado outbreaks out of season in the winter, as we saw with this latest outbreak. And so it's just another reminder that if anything, the impacts of climate change, when you look at the impact on extreme weather events, for example, the impact is actually greater than what we predicted just years ago. We're seeing increases in extreme weather events, you know, devastating extreme weather events that are greater than we expected. And we're seeing the disintegration of the ice sheets faster than we expected, which means we're going to get more of that sea level rise sooner than we expected. So, you know, it's I sound like a broken record when I say this, but uncertainty is not our friend. Scientific uncertainty means that things may in fact be significantly worse than we predicted just, you know, a decade or two ago. And it makes action all the more urgent.
Mm. Rebecca, we were struck by something Senator Manchin said on Fox yesterday. If I can't go home and explain this to the people of West Virginia, and we thought, okay, we've been reporting on this for, you know, since it was introduced, we could explain it to the people of West Virginia. You're saying you can't explain this? I mean, can you talk, Rebecca, about what this bill actually would do? I mean, so many young people were excited about the climate civilian corps. But what else in this bill really stood out for you as, you know, something that really would have an impact?
Yeah. So breaking down maybe from some of the most impactful climate policies and then getting it more into the weeds, the biggest thing this bill would have done is speed up our transition to 100% renewable energy. That is really the crux of the Biden kind of strategy to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And this bill, the policies here have been a bit of a moving target, but basically most of the funding for climate would have gone to clean energy tax credits, would have gone to speeding up the clean energy transition, improving transmission, all to ensure that we are electrifying parts of society that are still hooked up to fossil fuels and getting to that 100% clean energy target by 2035. Another part of this bill would target clean cars by increasing access and increasing subsidies for electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging stations. Going down the list, there's a lot of other important programs that Build Back Better would support. And that includes a lot of funding that actually bolsters communities' preparedness for climate disasters. There's a lot of funding that targets communities that are historically plagued by pollution called environmental justice communities, and helping tribes even relocate that have been affected and will continue to be affected by climate disasters. So without kind of giving the full laundry list, there's such a broad range of priorities here. This bill also bolsters a lot of spending for other key Democratic areas and priorities like replacing lead pipes. So this is a mix of investing in our physical infrastructure and also reducing our greenhouse gases. So I think it's important to remember how this is attacking the climate problem from multiple angles.
Yes. Thank you, Rebecca. I mean, you were able to list so many important things in just a couple minutes. Professor Mann, what would you add? Because so much of the coverage is on the politics rather than what's actually in the bill and the changes that we'd see as a result. So what would you add?
Yeah, well, I think Rebecca really put her finger on, you know, the most important thing that was in that bill was legislation or a policy, specifically the clean power standard, clean electricity standard that would allow the Biden administration to make good on the pledge that it has made to the rest of the world. We have pledged to reduce our carbon emissions by 50% within this decade, which is what we need to do as a planet collectively if we are to avert more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the planet, where we know we will see far worse consequences. So if we are to do that, if we are to avoid crossing that threshold of dangerous warming, we've got to bring our carbon emissions down dramatically. We've got to cut them in half within this decade. And the clean energy or clean electricity standard that was in that bill, the Build Back Better bill, at least the version that was passed by the House of Representatives, has, you know, provisions, as Rebecca already explained, to dramatically transition us away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. It uses market incentives, and we need market incentives to help us move dramatically in this direction. And, you know, those sorts of market incentives were once supported by Republicans. It was actually Republicans who gave us cap and trade. It was George H.W. Bush and his administration that actually put forward the idea of using tradable emissions permits, cap and trade, which is one form of market mechanisms for addressing an environmental crisis. And that was successfully implemented, and it helped us substantially improve the acid rain problem here in the United States and the rest of the world. So there was a time when Republicans were actually conservative when it comes to preserving our planet, the health of our planet. And they supported common sense market mechanisms consistent with their conservative ideology to do something about this problem. And unfortunately, we don't see a single Republican who's willing to support, you know, this legislation that will be good for the people, that provides so much of what's needed during this very difficult time, this health crisis that we're still working through, and addresses the most significant crisis that we face as a civilization, the climate crisis. All we can do is to, you know, continue to use every lever arm we have, our votes, our voices, the pressure of marching in the streets, calling out bad actors, organizing. We have to do everything we can to force our policymakers to do what's right for us rather than what happens to be profitable for a small number of moneyed interests.
Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War. Rebecca Lieber is climate change reporter with Vox. Her latest piece, Joe Manchin May Have Doomed American Climate Policy. We have a number of callers who've been waiting patiently, so let's go through them and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. About 40 years ago, somewhere around the around 80, 79, 80, 81, I pleaded with everyone that I could come across that it was the time to have no longer rely on two political parties. That with two political parties, you'd be at the point where you're at right now. And also, it does not allow everyone to have a voice. So it's going to take a long time now, unfortunately, to correct it. And I'll leave you with this thought. What would have happened if 40 years ago, as I pleaded, the Green Party worked on local wins and local governments and state governments and held 10 or 15 seats, 20 seats today? What would happen? What would have happened in those state legislatures? You'd have coalitions, and then majority could pass legislation.
Great point, Brad. Thank you so much for the comment. We'll get a response in just a couple of minutes. Let's hear next from Graham in Baltimore. Hi, Graham. Hi, Graham. Are you with us? Well, Graham just wanted to say that Manchin is using constituents as smoke screens, and he's only beholden to his donor class. Let's hear next from Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm a senior, and I am struggling on Social Security. I have rooftop solar, trying to pay my PG&E bill, being price gouged by PG&E and the state PUC. I support the Green New Deal with my rooftop solar. I use a electric vehicle. I use public transportation every time I go out of the house. The problem with the Build Back Better and the 2,100 pages is, first, it does not raise Social Security benefits. There's a direct correlation between solar and senior. It's not being made. The other thing is there's a very important piece of legislation. Somebody brought up a very important point earlier. I'd like to give out Bernie Sanders, Vermont Senate Office 802-862-0697, about Senate Bill 54, Vermont State Senate Bill 54, because this is so important. It is about soil regeneration, carbon sequestration. What SB 54 does is legalize marijuana in Vermont. The number one cash crop in California sequesters carbon. I love the Green New Deal. My question has been all along, if it's such a great idea, why not legalize it? Part of it is a felony. So how would seniors on rooftop solar be helped by this massive piece of paper? And West Virginia and the hypocrisy, because 70 million Americans receive benefits through Social Security.
Well, Mary, thank you for the call. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. We're actually going to be joined tomorrow by someone from Social Security Works to talk about the Medicare provisions of the bill. And I was planning to ask him about what it will take to raise Social Security benefits. So I hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. And we are going to do a rooftop solar show in January. So thank you so much for the call. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, happy Yalda, Rose, and your guest. The I'm afraid that your show is using too much logic, and that it might be smarter to use a couple of catchphrases. That Governor or that Senator Manchin wants America to have coal for Christmas, and the other idea is that they're fake conservatives. A real conservative would actually want to establish some normalcy, and the idea of externalized costs, the idea of a company just polluting and poisoning and then leaving the wreckage for the taxpayers to clean up after them. So fake conservatives is a theme that I'm leaning on with these guys.
Well, thank you for the call. To that point about conservatives, Rebecca, what people are so concerned about is that if Republicans win the House in November, it's really game over. We're not going to see any changes at all at the federal level. And that means what happens at the state level. I mean, there are some good things happening in California, but we've done shows about how a handful of Democrats in the state Senate have the power to block really strong climate legislation in California. So, you know, we can't have a hodgepodge of policies, but that might be the only option if Republicans take back the House. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So, like you said, we're on this timeline we're on a deadline, really, both for dealing with the climate crisis, but also politically, just because we have an election coming up where Democrats are likely to lose their majority in Congress. So does change this calculus that Democrats really don't have much time left to pass meaningful climate policy that can outlast the Biden administration. There's a lot of talk about what a plan B could look like, say, whether there really is no future for the provisions in the Build Back Better Act. And that plan B would include things like stronger executive action from Biden and also a really big push on the state and local level. These are not enough. They will not be enough to make up for what the federal government could do by investing billions into climate change. But certainly states have led the way in raising the bar. The problem is we see that generally happening in blue states. Even those states have faced some fierce fights from the fossil fuel industry, like in California. Mm-hmm. But things like these gas bans for new construction that New York City just passed this past week, that's kind of the silver lining in this bleak landscape that state and local policy continues to march forward in a lot of the country.
Right. But then you have to, like you said, you have to think, well, what about people in Mississippi? I mean, it's just so unfair for people in Mississippi to have to deal with Republicans who are not moving at all. In fact, we are also going to talk about the Medicaid expansion tomorrow. Professor Mann, what are your thoughts about what happens if Republicans take the House in November?
Yeah, I don't want to concede that that premise at this point. It's become popular in Beltway circles to pronounce Democrats dead on arrival in the next election. But that depends on what we do in the meantime to energize and organize Democrats. And to concede that now is to concede the whole game, frankly, because and I'm, you know, sometimes accused by some of my critics of not being alarmist enough. But I'm going to be a bit alarmist here and say that if we do lose Congress to the Republicans in this midterm election, I am not optimistic about our ability to maintain democracy in this country. And once again, without a Democratic United States leading in the climate battle, it's difficult to see the rest of the world's major polluters come to the table. And so it sounds like an overreach. It sounds overly dramatic, but it is in fact true that everything hinges on this midterm election and in Democrats not conceding that we will lose Congress to the Republicans, because once they have that, there's nothing to stop them from continuing the damage that we've seen over the past several years to our democracy.
Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Professor Mann, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Rebecca Lieber is a climate change reporter for Vox. You can find her latest piece at yourcallradio.org. Rebecca, thank you for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can also find an important story at yourcallradio.org from the Washington Post about Senator Manchin's trust, his family's coal company. I'll just read the intro. It says, in Senator Joe Manchin's hilly West Virginia home county, his family's business has made millions by taking waste coal from long abandoned mines and selling it to a power plant that emits air pollution at a higher rate than any other plant in the state. And you can find the piece called Manchin Cites a Blind Trust to Justify Climate Votes, but much income from his family's coal company is not covered. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vange for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.